So let me start with another story how this all started to happen. Fred already gave the introduction this morning on the collision runaways. And it really started in Tokyo when I was a young postdoc. And I had a discussion with Atsushi Kawai, he was a PhD student in Tokyo. And he said, well, we were talking about his master thesis project, and he said, well, my master thesis project was about collisions in star clusters. I said, well, you know, you have not much to write about, because there are no collisions in star clusters, because that was everything that was always told to me by my supervisor and all the books I read. And in the literature, there are no collisions between stars, period. And we just had a Grape 4, it was just finished, and he said, well, okay, why don't we try it tonight, right? We go, we put the computer to work, we go for dinner, and we did. We just had finished, say, basically the first serious production version of Starlab, which could do this sort of thing, should be able to do this sort of things. So we put Starlab to work on the Grape 4, which was this first teraflop machine ever built. And we went for dinner, and we had dinner, we had sushi, and we went back to the institute, and we had our first collision, and Starlab had crashed. So, so there was a collision, I was very happy, and it had crashed, so we repaired the code, put it to work again. Next morning we had like half a dozen collisions or so. And it was the first collision runaway calculation, basically, by done in our collaboration. And I was very suspect, so we tore Starlab completely apart, I didn't believe anything of it, put it all back together again, run it again, and bloody hell, we have another collision. So it didn't go away. And then in the end we decided, well, maybe this is physics, maybe the code tries to tell us something, and we started thinking about it. And that's how we started writing and getting into the collision runaway regime. Now, apart from this sort of stories, I will try to give you a few motivations why you would like to study collision runaways, more than giving you a very deep, detailed, inside view of the different regimes of collision runaways or the different physics which plays a role, like for example binaries may be very important, or whether or not the stellar sizes are very important, or to what level of degree do they propagate into the effect of collision runaways. I mean, you can endlessly talk about it, but as Fred already alluded to, there's a lot of uncertainty in, for example, the whole physical regime, the initial parameters. The basic physics basically stays the same, right? The collision runaway does happen, or the runaway collision. I started calling it a runaway collision. Ed was very unhappy because he had something else in mind with runaways. But I rather spend the time here to give you a few of the motivations why we think that these runaway collisions may lead to something like intermediate mass black hole, even though we don't think they do, right? And why we do not think they do. And then after my talk, I think Evert will tell you something about the further stellar evolution implications and consequences of these collision runaways. And then you close the door. I don't know. The other way around? Okay, so you do more probably of the technical stuff. So you basically, that's actually maybe even a better way. So you can do more the technical stuff of what is the physics behind the collision runaway, with the exception that you will mostly talk about the very high, extremely large cluster things we don't do with M-body. So there is another regime you will probably not talk about, which is a little bit milder, and it happens in different clusters, possibly, which is more related to, for example, binary formation and binary evolution rather than the pure exponential growth of a collision runaway. So there are different regimes. Maybe I get to that, but I don't think I will. So there are four main motivations, I think, and if there are more, I would like to know them. There was an ultra-bright, super-bright, I don't know how they call them these days, supernova 2006 GY, which occurred in a galaxy far, far away, which outshone the galaxy for a while, and it stays bright up today, way brighter than a normal supernova. I will show a light curve soon. So one model to explain that supernova, there are several models to explain it. One is a pair creation instability. And one model Ed van der Heuvel and I came up with is a collision runaway, and then the runaway product in the end will go supernova, and that will sort of make such a big bang. Well, it will not make a big bang, but it will make a large supernova that could explain some of the features observed in supernova 2060Y with consequences, right? There are predictable consequences out of that.
Are you going to discuss that in more detail?
Slightly, yes. Yeah? You want more detail or less detail?
More.
Okay. I think it's a very interesting case, and it still is very bright. I just looked it up on the net. The ultraluminous X-ray source in M82, that's the brightest ultraluminous X-ray source in M82, of course. I'll say something about that. The unusually high velocity dispersion IRS-13, IRS-16 I leave out of this discussion, but IRS-13 is a special case, possibly. And the hypervelocity star with this telephone number, you can look him up, who he is or she, and it's a he, right? I think those are the three main motivations to study or believe or consider intermediate mass black holes as serious outcomes of collision runaways or of other existing physical processes. So supernova 2006 DY occurred on 18 September 2006, observed by Quinley and Mondal. And it is at the distance of 300 parsec from the center of NGC 1260, which is an SB galaxy. I'll show you in a minute. The galaxy is a distance of 72 megaparsec, as you can see here. You can look up the coordinates. And this is an artist impression, of course. We don't have these nice observations of the thing. It's a wonderful, these artist impressions. This is actually a rather mild artist impression. Do you remember the planets in the triple system, right? When there was a planet observed in a triple system, which is a fantastic discovery, of course. But then the artists made an image where you look at the planet and the three suns on the horizon from a moon around the planet. I mean, why do things have to be more beautiful than science isn't at all, in nature is normally. Anyway, the galaxy is here in Perseus. And I wanted to show you the image of the galaxy first. Let me first show you the image of the galaxy. This is the image of the galaxy, and this is the supernova. Right? And it is very nearby. It's a few hundred parsec from the center of the galaxy. If this supernova is like a supermassive black hole or something like that, it would have sunken into the galaxy already, but it didn't do it. It's clearly part of the galaxy. Now, why is 2006 EY extraordinary? It's 100 times brighter than supernova 1987A, which doesn't say much because it was a rather dim supernova, but it's at least 10 times brighter than any other supernova observed. There are a few actually more which also are very bright, but it's unusually bright. There is one solar mass of hydrogen in the spectrum of the supernova, which is, you know, suggest it's a type 2 supernova. There is 5 to 20 solar masses of hydrogen in the surroundings of the supernova. So again, you would say, hey, that's a sort of a massive star that blows out some of its material and then it goes bangs a little bit left over on the surface. But it sounds like a type 2 supernova. But the abundance of calcium and silica 2 suggests it's a type 1a supernova. So it's a sort of a supernova which mimics a type 2, depending on how you look at it, and on the other side it looks like a type 1. So it's a very peculiar object, and no gamma rays observed, but it's a bright X-ray source. Right? So it's an unusual supernova already from the spectroscopy and the brightness, of course, and the material around the supernova itself, so the hydrogen present in the supernova remnant. Now the brightness is amazing. You can see that here over the last 200 days or so, the 200 days after the supernova. It first goes up very quickly, and then it sort of cuts into a plateau, which is considerably higher than any other supernova observed. So why is this 10 to 100 times brighter than all the other supernovae? And why does it stay so flat also? Right, there are several models to explain that. And one way to explain that is a runaway collision which leads to a supernova which... funny things. I will go into a little bit more detail in a second. Let me give you the other example.
So that's an SB galaxy, right?
That's an SB galaxy, yes.
So you're predicting that there's a 10 million year old or less star cluster hiding behind that supernova?
That's right. Yeah. Well,
but
around.
If it's an SB, do you really expect that there to be that much star formation out of that part of the galaxy?
Well, I mean, this is not very far out, right? But it is. That's the prediction, right? The prediction is that on the location of the supernova there would be a star cluster.
Wait, right. As you said, it's only a few hundred parsecs.
No, maybe it's. Well, let me see how much it is.
300 parsecs from the center.
Okay. It looks different from the picture.
Okay. Yeah, okay, but the picture looked different. It's 300 parsecs from the center, so it's really very nearby. The
center. Yeah, you're right. No, it's
right?
The picture is deceptive.
The picture is I mean, the galaxy is hardly visible, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's I think there is some dust here and things like that. I mean, I'm not sure that there is no star formation, but it's so the prediction is there is a star cluster on the location of supernova. But today I looked it up, and it's still too bright to see the star cluster. So the prediction Ed van de Heuvel and I made a year ago is saying, like, there will be star, after in a year you will see the star cluster, but, you know, we still can't see it. So I'm still safe, right? Still can't see the star cluster. Supernova is still too bright. I hope it stay bright for another 10 years. This is the Chandra observations of M82, X1, well, of M82. And M82 has also a very bright X-ray source. Here you see the bright X-ray source on, and here you see the bright X-ray source off. And it is an ultra-luminous X-ray source. It's 10 to the 42 Earths per second or so. And it was discovered in 1999. And it is at about 100 parsecs from the center of M82. So it's also very nearby the center of that galaxy. And in projection. And so here the green, in the center of the galaxy is this green dot observed. And they don't know what it is. The observers, of course, they put it there for some reason. And this is also an object which could be explained by an intermediate mass black hole. I'll come to the details also in a minute. Here you see it. The fun thing of M82X2 is that there is a star cluster right on top of the X-ray source, which is MGG11, which is a star cluster where Evert also will talk about, which Holger and I and Steve McMillan and... Help me out, Holger. Who else was on the paper?
June and Pete.
We did the simulations of the object and of this object, which is MGG9, which is another cluster which looks very similar to MGG11, but there's no X-ray source in MGG9. So why is there one in MGG11 and why there's none in MGG9? We argue that this is a little bit more massive and a little bit bigger, and this is in the range of making a collision runaway, and this is just outside the range of making a collision runaway. And you can see here where sort of they are in the X-ray picture of M82. And of course, there's also not F, and not F is different ballpark, right? That's a... How do you call these things again, Fred? Yodex, right? Isn't it? Then yes, he. He is a hypervelocity star. It zips with a velocity of more than 700 kilometers per second through the galaxy. The star itself is a main sequence star. It's 35 million years old. But if you would think that like hypervelocity stars are produced by the supermassive black hole in the galactic center in interaction with a normal star or a binary, with the supermassive black hole being pushed with very high velocity from the supermassive black hole into away from the galactic center, basically, that travel time at the observed velocity would be about 80 to 110 million years, considerably longer than the age of the star. So why would that star, i.e., it may be a blue straggler, right, which sort of mimics half its age as it really is. On the other side, it's much easier if it would have come from the Large Magellanic Cloud. I mean, the travel time from the Large Magellanic Cloud at this velocity is about 20 million years. So look for a star cluster, which is 35 million years old. And, you know, 25 million years ago, 20 million years ago, it sort of would have produced a hypervelocity star. And there are two star clusters in the ballpark which could do this, NGC 2100 and 2004. I think this should be SMC, actually. I think it's the SMC we are talking about. The distance to the object is so far that only the radial velocity is predominant, right? You only observe the radial velocity. Okay. Yeah. So the velocity is a lower limit. But the velocity is a lower limit. If it goes sideways very fast, then it doesn't help you in constraining the velocity towards the galactic center, right? Now, in the galaxy, how do you get to these objects? It's because, let's look at the galaxy. In the galaxy, we have a number of objects which are also of interest. And, for example, it's IRIS 13. And a few years ago, in particular, Maillard and Schödel discovered IR-13, which was already hiding there, but they did very accurately the velocity measurements of the stars. Here you see the velocity measurements of the stars. Here you see your infrared image. And the velocity of the objects is clustered together, so it looks like a sort of co-moving group. It's only a few stars, right? So it's a dozen stars, so in total. And it looks like they're co-moving with respect to the other stars, which are also in random directions, but all orbiting the black hole, but in random orbits. And this group of stars orbit together the supermassive black hole around the galactic center at a distance of 0.18 parsec. So it's really nearby the supermassive black hole. And the only way... So this could be coincident that they're just, you know, stuck together. It could be. But it could also be that it is sort of the remnant of a star cluster, or it is a little star cluster, which is bind together by something. And in order to bind it together, you need something like between, now, 1,000 and 20,000 solar masses to keep this thing bound in a bound orbit around the supermassive black hole. So the suggestion is that there is an intermediate mass black hole which binds these objects together. There is an X-ray source in this box. So the arrow bar is the box is the arrow bar for the X-ray source. It's not super bright or something like that. It's just, you know, there is an X-ray source. Right? I mean, people like to associate black holes with X-ray sources. I don't really know why. I mean, they're black, right? The background's black. Don't need an X-ray source. But it's nice. It would be nice to have an X-ray source on top of it. Now, star clusters come in all sorts of varieties. You all know about this. But let me just show you this to give you an idea of scale, right? Sometimes I miss the idea of scale in all the discussion about Yodex or other star clusters. Here you see the Pleiades below. You can't see it because you'll know it by heart, right? On the same scale, we have here M80, which is the largest globular cluster. And on the same scale, MGG11, the star cluster I just talked about. R136, the star cluster in the 30 Doradus region, in the Taranza Nebula, at the same scale. So you see sort of what clusters they are. NGC-3603, has been mentioned in the past few days. Westerlund 1, the quintuplets, didn't get the attention it deserves. The Archer's cluster, younger and more compact than quintuplets, and almost at the same distance from the galactic center, slightly smaller. And the Trapezium cluster, right? The star cluster in the core of the Orion Nebula. And you see the scale, 5 parsec, 30 parsec, this is all to scale. Now the masses, this object is a million solar masses, right? This object is a few thousand solar masses. The Archer's cluster and the quintuplets are of the order of 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 solar masses. Xiongshu Kim and I have a disagreement on this. But I like the massive range and you like the low mass range. But it's between 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 5. And these are somewhat in between, right? MGG11 is probably the most massive cluster, young, dense cluster here. With something like 10 to the 5 solar masses. Right? Just to give you a scale. Now, where runaway collisions can happen, clearly not in the Pleiades, right? Too low density, and in this case also too old. And not in the Trapezium, too few stars. Not in M80. It's nice and massive, but it's too big. Too low density, too large relaxation time, and in this case, of course, too old. Right? If there was an intermediate mass black hole in there, it was formed, you know, 10 billion years ago or so. So in which of these do we expect an intermediate mass black hole, and which of these do we not? Now for MGG11, we do expect an intermediate mass black hole. There is an X-ray source on top of it, and it fits very nice with the models. There's of course no guarantee, right, in this branch of sports. R136, the Archers and quintuplets, probably not. They're just probably, the way they look now, They look a bit fluffy for making intermediate mass black holes by collision runaways. Westerlund 1 is in the ballpark, and NGC-3603 also. Right, so that gives you an idea of where would you like to look for if you want to look at it. Now, I said before that something like the R136 is only observed recently, right? So why is that? Now, if you think about how the Archer's cluster was discovered, you immediately realize that the whole galaxy may be brimming with star clusters like the Archer's cluster, simply because they're not very easy to see. So here you see the radio image, which led to the discovery of the Archer's cluster. Now, on the radio image, you see these arcs, right, which is filaments of magnetic fields and gas being excited into the magnetic field filaments. And then they started looking at something looks like pushing away these arcs, right? There must be some wind or something like that making these arcs. And then they started looking and they found a very little thingy here, which is magnified here. And then they started looking in optical and infrared, and then it was bingo, right? Infrared was clear, this is a star cluster, and X-ray, it was even observable in X-rays. And then they realized this is, Don Figer made these beautiful infrared observations. And then the discussion was over. There is a star cluster. The star cluster contains young stars. The young stars blow a wind, and the wind blows the bubble and causes the arcs to exist. If the radio observations on which the star cluster is completely invisible were not made, we would not have found this object, right? Of course, with two mass, it's different now, right? Two mass, you can just see the cluster, basically. So you can map out the clusters and compare them with the X-ray sources, for example. So it's easier, but it's not a run race. So a few years ago, we made this image, where we made an estimate of how many star clusters we expect in the galactic center, up to a distance of about 150 or 200 parsec. And there is a dash line. The dash line here is basically star clusters which cannot survive. Right, so if a cluster gets older, it gets dimmer, it becomes harder to observe. So the gray shading becomes lighter in that direction, but if the cluster gets too old, it simply disappears, right? It evaporates in the meantime. And if the cluster is farther away from the galactic center, it becomes harder to observe because the cluster can become bigger. It can fill its rush lobe in the tidal field of the galactic center. And here, the two observed clusters, we did statistics on two objects, and we predicted that there would be about 100 star clusters like arches or quintuplets within 100 or 200 parsec of the galactic center. Actually, if you look now at the 2 months observations, it seems to be that there about 100 or 200 star clusters within 100 parsec of the galactic center. So we can do good statistics with two objects. I guess we're just lucky. Now, if you do that, if you compare also the mass function of those star clusters you would sort of expect, that fits very nice with the observed mass function. This is the observed mass function. You can make estimates of the mass function you would sort of think those star clusters have. So these are clusters which are younger than something like 10 million years. And there are three models and all sort of bracket almost the observations at that time, right? The data is from Borisova 2005. So that's the bullets, and we made these lines in it and concluded that we can't be far off extrapolating to 200. Now, a star cluster, as Fred already alluded to, is a very special object, right? Stars are moving around, and you don't see that here, so I will do this again. But if you simulate them, you will see that it is a sort of a beehive of stars. So stars are moving around very actively, and in the middle, it's very busy, and at the outside, it's not very busy. Now, if these stars sink to the center of the star cluster, they are coming into the busy regime. Now, in the busy regime of the star cluster, in the core of the star cluster, stars move around very rapidly, relatively high velocities compared to the outside. And the other thing what happens is the star cluster goes into core collapse. And if a star cluster goes into core collapse, several interesting things happen. First of all, the density goes up. The number of stars in the very high density region decreases dramatically. There's only a few stars really in the core region. And the other thing is that the orbits of stars also start making sort of a transition from very regular to very irregular. So you see here an example of a simulation where we have a star cluster at the start. We start with a Plummer sphere and we let it go into core collapse. And here you see the orbits of two stars. The little circle in the middle, the dotted circle, is the core radius. And 0.5 is half mass radius. And the dotted circle is the core radius, and the blue circle is the half mass radius. And these are the orbits of two stars. You see, they're very regular orbits. So just, you know, they just make their orbits in the potential of the cluster. Now, if the cluster collapses, you see here the collapsed cluster. And you see particle 6 out of 100,000 particles of this simulation. And instead of being regular, it now has a very irregular motion. It is in a binary once in a while. It catches somebody else. It comes nearby another guy or girl. And then it moves around another direction. And this is sounding exactly the same. So the chaoticity of the system increases at core collapse. And it's not only the chaoticity which is important, but it's also these binaries, right? Here the object is in a binary with another star. We can't see the other star because we only plotted this one. But obviously there is another star around. Now, having two stars together, that means that the cross-section for interaction is larger than just the size of the star. Right? As Melvin already showed, right, with his dancing sort of way of doing, the star, the cross-section of a star is not just the size of the star, but it's the size of the star multiplied by a factor which is inversely proportional to the velocity dispersion, right? I mean, they're attractive. Throwing stars at each other is not like playing darts. Playing darts is very difficult. You have a very small target, you throw an arrow, but playing darts in sort of a gravitational regime, you throw your dart in a random direction and ends up in bullseye. Right? This is a star cluster. The star cluster is doing this for you. Gravity is helping you out. So that's why these collisions happen in the first place. And now we should go to the next slide. Fred will be so happy if this crashes. So here you see how it happens. Two stars hit each other. This is a simulation done by James Lombardi of two stars. They hit each other, you get some rotation, and they hit each other again and again, and in the end they merge. And the funny thing is, the difference between doing this in hydro or doing this with sticky spheres, like what you do normally in an embodied simulation to speed up your calculation and to prevent all the trouble of programming it. This goes so bad because I guess my computer is not fast enough. I should call David maybe. But even if the stars would miss, they would still end up in a bound pair because the little friction, probably they're already bound at the moment they meet. They're in a sort of a bound situation. They pass each other at relatively large distance. The hydrodynamical interaction, even at the boundary layers of the stars, is enough to get them a little bit closer. If they're a little bit closer, it means they're going into the collision anyway. But the two-body collisions are extremely rare in the embodied simulation I'm talking about, right? In your regime, two-body collisions are more likely to happen because you're in a way denser and a way larger environment. But in a stellar dynamical case, in the case for direct embodied, which is approachable for direct embodied, we say 100,000 stars or so, it's a three-body case which is important. Because three bodies are much larger. Now, what happens if you do a three-body encounter? For example, in this case, you meet a binary. You make a binary in the core of the star cluster and another star drops in. Now, if you do it with sticky spheres, this is sort of what happens. This is one of the sticky sphere simulations we did with Evgeny Gabirov. There's a binary, there's another star. Other star comes in, hits the binary. Thing is over. And if it doesn't hit, let's say this is the sticky sphere, this is the SPH. So in the SPH situation, you track the stars, and it hits the binary, and then you get a sort of a hydrodynamical mess with three cores, and the three cores, the three stars, sort of move around in a completely different sort of environment. And it's a completely different encounter than in this case. Now, of course, you make nice movies of that too. I see a binary in a single star, and then the single star, the little star, the secondary of the binary, stays in orbit around this merger product, and due to the friction, in the end, in the sticky sphere case, this will not be a triple collision. But in the hydrodynamical case, this will be a triple collision. So this could be the start of a runaway collision, right? We forget all the other stars around it, and in the end, they merge.
That was an incredibly hard binary you started with.
That was a hard binary. This was actually a binary from a simulation. We literally took out of the simulation the binary and the single star, and we smashed them into each other.
But I would think your typical three-body binary is a 1 kT binary. This is much, much harder.
No, the typical binary, at the moment they start colliding, are 1,000 kT. So by the moment you really get into the collisional regime, they can be. If you have a 1 kT binary, it's much harder to get a collision. Because then the stars are relatively small compared to the separation of the binary.
Yeah, but see, when you get the resonant enhancement during the interaction, you gain a factor 100 back.
Yeah, if you're 10 kT or so.
But sometimes we have a triple collisions even if you don't need the hydro. I mean, even if your body will predict this.
Yeah, I was just about to say. So that, with the sticky sphere approximation, would give a triple collision. And the reason is that when the first two things collide, there's an expansion factor. It's a parameter, but it comes from Jamie Lombardi's SPH recipes, which give, you know, this entropy sorting stuff. So when those two things collide, instead of giving it the radius of a mid-sequence star, it's that radius times some factor. And it's usually two or three, that's generically. So that would...
Yeah, then you get a triple collision. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, you can also do it with SPH. Yeah. It's more fun. You get more nice movies.
Yeah, of course.
But if you have an expansion factor, then that will lead to... But this is a binary taken from an embodied simulation, Fred, which had such an encounter. So not all collisions happen in soft binary.
They already hardened considerably through flybys before you got to this collision.
Yeah. Yeah, it's taken out of context, right?
I think that is not typical, though. That typically the first collision would happen for something. I mean, I understand that...
It depends on the regime, right?
I mean, it makes it both a better movie and an easier calculation to do with SPH. The binary to begin with is stuck. I doubt that this is typical.
Well, I think it depends on the regime of the star clusters you are studying, right? So there are star clusters where, I mean, this was a simulation just taken from, well, maybe it was a bit chosen for the apparent. I should ask James or Evgeny.
Did you have primordial binaries on the initial cluster?
No.
This was without primordial binaries.
That's
yeah.
Why it's so hard.
Yeah.
I mean, if you started with some 30 KT binaries.
So this is another movie. Let me show again. Now the incoming star is low mass. Oh no, now the incoming star is high mass. This is the same movie? Oh, maybe I have two times the same movie. So we have an incoming is high mass.
That's the first one you showed.
That's the first one I showed. So the second one I show?
Light is different.
That's different.
That's different. Okay, well, it looks like almost the same. That's the same. It looks the same to me. No. Now, they may be chosen a little bit onto the regime for doing this. But the original calculation started without primordial binaries. And the binary was hardened by other effects. Now, in the end, they merge.
And this was the first collision in your simulation?
No, not necessarily.
Not
necessarily. But the first collision is these stars, not that.
Okay.
Actually, I should retrace that. This is the first collision in simulation because all simulations were run up to the first collision, and then we stopped. So it must be the first collision in simulation. Yeah. So that is in the low end regime. What happens is two stars make a binary. The binary is hardened, and in the end you have an interaction that sort of smashes into one of the stars, or the two stars are driven together so closely that they become a contact binary with probably a small mass ratio, and therefore they merge also. Completely different than the regime you talk about. This is really the low end, small relaxation time regime. Now, the collision runaways, Holger and I did a few years ago, well, almost half a decade ago, where with two different codes, M44 and Starlab, in order to mimic MGG11. And via this sort of collisions, we grow to a mass of something like between 1,000 and almost 3,000 solar masses. You see, there is no serious mass loss on the main sequence. And once it collapses into a black hole, that's where the stars are, the mass basically remains almost constant. There are a few collisions after the black hole forms, but not that many. Most collisions happen before, and the reason is that, first of all, the black hole is very small, so if it's a star, before it's the black hole, it's a star, it's much bigger, it's much easier to collide. And after the supernova, there's so much mass lost by also other supernovae that the sort of the core expands, the density drops, and it becomes harder to make collisions.
What's again the difference between the black stars and the
open stars is M44, and the black stars is Starlab. So M44 has a different prescription for stars, different recipe for stars. The stars are a bit bigger in M44 than in Starlab on this high mass regime. And therefore you get a higher collision runaway, a higher mass in the collision runaway than in Starlab. But apart from that, there is basically, they're almost indistinguishable. Also the way in which the collisions happen. You first make a binary, the binary makes collisions, and everything happens via modulated by binaries. Now you can take those evolutionary tracks and model them. That's what Evert will talk about. So together with Lev Jungelsen, we then started to see what happens if you take a 100 or 1,000 solar mass star and evolve it. And Lev was visiting Amsterdam for a while, and he has been tweaking Peter Eckleton's code until we reached 1,001 solar mass star, which we evolved. And you see how it evolves. It goes down in luminosity very dramatically, and then it makes a loop and it settles basically just below the range for just above the as an LBV basically, right? Here are the LBVs, and this line here, the green line you can't see, but it runs here, is the Humphrey-Davidson limit, where you shouldn't have too many stars above. So the way we tweaked mass loss rate in the stellar evolution models was to assure that we wouldn't get too many stars above the Humphrey-Davidson limit. Otherwise, we would be wildly in contradiction to the observations.
Metallicity
here is solar, I think. I think it was solar.
So you don't have the physics of the the radial pulsations, right?
No, there's no physics of radial pulsations here.
Just put in some mass loss.
There's a prescription for mass loss.
What these overstable pulsations would actually produce.
Exactly, yeah. And that is done in a parameter, and the parameter is alpha, and Evert may know what alpha is, but I do not. Here, now.
Something in the exponents, the mass loss rate is proportional to something like 1 over 1 minus gamma to alpha to the alpha minus 1.
Yeah. But the alpha was chosen to prevent too many stars like AG Carina and Iris, whatever, and the Eta Carina and Pistol Star and things like that, right? You would like to be able to have a few there, but not too many. So, you know, it's a bit of turning the knobs, right? The result, however, Pistol Star, of course, no observational picture, very nice, they exist, these things. The result of this calculation and other calculations, we already talked about Van Beveren and Julia Belkus, and also Evert now will publish a paper about this, where you see how you go from 1,000 solar mass at an age of, almost zero, and how the mass of the star drops dramatically to 200 or 100 solar masses before it starts in become a supernova, basically. So it loses all its mass, except for maybe a few tens, or maybe 50, maybe 100 if you have low metallicity. This is low Z, so you end up with something like 150 or so. But it's very difficult to get higher than 150 solar masses. You really have to go to very low metallicity, or an alternative like what Evert will show. If you put in collisions in the middle, then you can beef up this number a little bit. Right? So for pure stellar evolution, our assumption here is that the stellar evolution is not seriously perturbed by any collisions. You have the mass of 1,000 solar mass at the beginning, basically, of the star.
You also assume that you actually know something about the mass loss rate, which you...
That's right. That's right. There is nothing to constrain it on. Yeah, that's right.
You just put in, I mean, everything you see here is just what you put in.
Well, you don't want... I mean, if this star remains too high mass, you get it. You get many stars... Well, if you have many of these stars, you get them all above the Humphrey-Davis limit.
The observed objects that would be constraining this, like the Pistol Star, Eta Carina, you really don't know where they started.
That's right. That's right.
And so there's nothing else.
Right. But this is if you would put it in a normal stellar evolution code and just run it, right?
No. But if you run it with that mass loss prescription, which is basically everything you see here. I mean, there's very little here that comes from any
stellar
physics.
So the mass loss is not coming from the physics.
No.
There's no mass loss coming from physics.
So what's the boundary? Nobody knows.
You know, the devil is in...
I only remember one older paper, I think it was Franca d'Antona and a couple of other people, where they actually tried to calculate these pulsations with a dynamics code. And they were trying to see how the period varies with metallicity and trying to actually get things to be a bit quantitative.
Right.
I don't know if more work of that type has been done recently where people seriously look at what happens to a 500 solar mass object.
We don't understand LVB mass loss rates.
No.
I think Norbert is the person really...
Man's models were not for them.
Who works on this, right? Norbert Langer.
They were high enough that you would get a few of these cycles in it.
Albert Jan van Marle was Norbert Langer did or is doing models with Stan Wocky of...
Stanowski. I talked about porosity. Sorry. Anyway, this is a pessimistic scenario. I mean, because this would mean you don't get intermediate mass black holes, right? Except if you call 150 solar mass an intermediate mass black hole. So I completely agree with you, Fred. The mass loss rate is completely arbitrary, put in, constrained on something. We don't even know if that's the right way to constrain it. And then you don't get any intermediate mass black holes, if that's what you do.
Yeah, but so still, there must be some justification behind that alpha of 0.25, presumably.
Can
just pick this out of a hat?
Well, he did a lot of fine tuning on it.
What do you mean fine tuning?
Well, to get not too many stars in every day.
I guess in my talk as well.
You know where
this
it is.
Alpha, I mean, there's this slightly ad hoc mass loss prescription, but the alpha was tuned such that it more or less agrees with predictions of line-driven winds for stars of 50 solar masses or something. I don't remember the exact mass for which it was calibrated.
That is here, right? 50 solar masses here.
Yes, but we have some of those to look at.
Yeah, that's right. We don't have anything here to look at. So this is pure fantasy in some sense, right? It's doing a sort of... okay. Anyway, if you have a collision runaway in a star cluster, this is from old paper, if you don't have any collisions, you just, from the start of your initial mass function, if all stars are born at the same age, at T0, say, right, the ideal situation, you know, if you look up in your stellar evolution model, exactly when all the supernovae happened, right? You can just count them out. In the stellar dynamical regime, you can't do that anymore, because some supernova are unaffected by the collision runaway. Some supernova appear where there was none before. That is the star which was rejuvenated, basically, this star which was rejuvenated, and therefore the supernova came later. And that became some sort of supernova like 2060Y, possibly. And there are supernovae which are disappearing, right? These stars never exploded because they were gobbled up by the collision runaway and produced this special supernova, right? So the whole supernova history of your cluster is affected, and therefore also metallicity, etc., evolution of your cluster may be affected by the collision runaway. Okay, I want to say something about the runaways, but maybe the time is also... What are we doing in time?
You've talked for a long time.
I'll talk for a long time. Let's we can continue just discussing and... let me go to a conclusion page, at least, then.
Well, in 15 minutes, we're going to coffee, so...
So okay. Let's discuss for 15 minutes, and then after coffee, about 3:30, we'll come back and start.
So there are some other constraining factors. But this is sort of the summary slide. Intermediate mass black hole, so there are some consequences. The core collapse and the runaway collision itself has never been observed. So it would be nice to see a collision between two stars, right? Or to see two stars which really get into such a regime where you get a collision.
You don't think the pistol star is your perfect...
But the pistol star is outside the cluster. Right, so that you know, it's 2 parsecs away from the center of the quintuplet cluster, which is rather it's three times the tidal radius.
Besides, you don't know that it's collision. Speculate.
Well, but it's a very good candidate. I completely agree that it's a good candidate. So an evidence for it or an indication for it may be something like anomalous X-ray pulsars in young star clusters or something like that. Right, the one in Westerlund 1. I don't know, maybe this is too much fantasizing it.
Is there any way to eject star-like?
Yeah, you can. You can, in principle, if you have a collision runaway object, you can eject it and start building a new one. So the cluster will do not care that much, right? It loses a little bit of mass.
So you really can get a runaway runaway?
You can get a runaway runaway. Yeah, a runaway runaway is a very good term for it.
How? If so it is the possible. Most massive thing in the cluster?
Yeah, but you can make a tough binary, and if the binary is has bad luck and doesn't make collisions, it can generate energy to eject the object.
These are big stars. And
it's not something that happens in every simulation. But it is something that once in a while...
Do we have one of these in the galaxy?
So if we have one of these in the galaxy, we must have many cases where it didn't manage to escape, I think. Well, the escape velocity of the quintuplet cluster is not very high. You don't have to push it very hard.
If it got 2 parsecs in less than 3 million years, then it was moving at a few kilometers a second.
But that's what you need also to escape.
Yeah, exactly.
And you may escape with the whole binary. Right? I mean, you don't have to escape alone. It can carry the other guy, girl with him.
It's easy
yeah.
To escape alone.
If this stuff is happening all the time and it's almost escaping, wouldn't that tremendously heat the core? Or if you've had multiple ejection events, like, wouldn't that produce a huge core in the center of a globular cluster?
Well, there is of course heating going on, right? I mean, these things heat the cluster, the collision runaway, but they also cool the cluster.
This is a sort of direct mechanism. Okay.
It's a competing effect between heating and cooling.
It's like getting, if this big, you know, 1,000 mass thing is getting, 1,000 solar mass thing is getting almost ejected and then decaying back and moving all around, it just seems like it would be a huge heating source.
Right, but in the end, it is a negative heat capacity system. It will go back into core collapse. And even if it's heated, you will get a few escapers and it will go back into the regime for collision runaway. Except if you really perturb it dramatically by a number of supernovae.
So,
I've seen models where 2006 GY is apparent stability supernova.
Yeah.
Do you look at that as a channel in your models and see what fraction of stars actually make it into black holes as opposed to complete detonation?
As going into apparent stability?
Yeah.
Yeah, we never really looked at the statistics on that, because then you have to know something about the statistics of the initial conditions.
Well, but I mean, these merging stars should go through the apparent stability zone. If they linger there too long, then they're going to detonate before they grow about it.
Yeah. Well, that may be an alternative for... It is an alternative for 2016. And Woosley and co-workers did a paper on that.
I'm just worried about it would come in as an efficiency factor in making IMBHs, but not a lot of IMBHs you'd otherwise have to form.
Yeah, you should count. You could count all those sorts of supernovae and say this is the birth rate of IMBHs times an efficiency factor of the ones who go apparent stability. Yeah, yeah, maybe nice exercise.
The IRS-13 thing went away. Because in the Mailer paper they claimed, oh, it's an IMBH, and then somebody looked at it more carefully and it just wasn't clear at all. Do you remember there was some follow-up paper after Midline? So the paper was 2004 or whatever, and then people started noticing it in 2006, and then there was some paper, some modeling paper, where they said, oh, this is ridiculous.
But there are also papers from the original team again where they reclaim that it is correct.
Okay. So you actually believe it? You think there's...
Well, I don't necessarily... I'm not... I just present here sort of the optimistic view, right? Maybe I should also refer to the people who claim the opposite.
Have you thought about how you'd set up a cluster so that this would happen? You want the core collapse time scale to be less than the main sequence lifetime of massive stars. So that's a few million years. That's actually the sort of internal dynamical time scale of the cluster. So would you actually be likely to set up a situation where you could have this core collapse occurring before the stars themselves have gone supernova or evolved off the main sequence? Is that a likely situation?
No, there are a few star clusters where if you do the estimate of the relaxation time of the star cluster, it that would be shorter than the lifetime of the most massive main sequence stars.
I think that's the case of Arches.
Yeah, Arches is on the edge. So there are several cases on the edge where you sort of say, hey, they could be in ballpark of doing this. And I think Arches... I'm not sure that Arches is really in the collisional regime.
Mild core collapse, and you can plot out density, core density against time.
Yeah.
And it goes a little bit high and then comes down. It's not typical of global cluster core collapse, but it's... I mean, yeah, I think it's a very mild collapse.
But the question is it enough to trigger the runaway? So the other clusters are...
So is the Arches cluster, has it had core collapse then?
I think so, yes. And the quintuplet is larger because it's extended.
So again, we're not using the right language here. But for small clusters like Arches type, and it's too small to have anything you can really identify as a core collapse. You just don't have... You're talking about five stars doing something near the center. There's no sense of really a core collapsing. If you go to much larger systems where we can do simulations, supersonic
times,
no, they may not be. I mean, if you believe that these clusters are born with the kind of 3 parsec type virial sizes that we measure at 100 megayear, then yes. But if they're born with typical core sizes that are less than about a parsec.
Well, half the parsec. Plus, it expands before the first supernova supernova happens. So something is heating other than this massive stellar.
So it's really all about, for the large systems we had this discussion this morning, it's all about taking that magic three parsecs that everybody says seems to be universal in this measure today, and taking it back in time to whatever you want to call t equals zero. And if it goes down by at least a factor of, let's say, 5 to 10, as you would like, to t equals 0, that takes you into the runaway regime under fairly conservative assumptions about the IMF and any kind of primordial mass segregation, that these things will help you increase the collision rate.
Answering your question, basically?
Well, I think so. Another way to rephrase this would be of the clusters that you you've considered, you know, do you know of other examples that are in this regime where this will?
But basically, these young dense star clusters are in the ballpark regime of doing something like this. Yeah.
But to be fair, Simon, the simulations you did where you had these very high W knots, 11.
Yeah.
We don't really know that, right?
No, we don't know that. But
so there's also, you know, how much concentration. So
yeah.
That's really what I'm asking.
And
could you go to a catalog of star clusters and say?
We don't know.
This is likely to happen here and here and here, but not here.
The only way where you can do that is to go to the youngest star clusters and say if they now are in the regime of doing it. It's very hard to calculate backwards from the current observed parameters to the ballpark initial conditions of the star cluster. So you really have to go to young objects where you see they're still in this regime, and I think that's the best.
And they have main sequence.
And have main
sequence. Massive main sequence.
Yeah.
And they have to be really young. I mean, they have... If
they have to be younger than 3 million years, 10 million years or so. Younger than 10 million years. If 10 million years, you can still...
Less than that.
Exactly. Yeah.
You
need to be really at 2 to 3 million years.
Yeah, ideally, yeah.
And close enough if you actually want to measure core sizes.
Yeah. But like, for example, an MPG-11 is 10 million years old. In that case, you can sort of do a parameter search of the initial conditions to see what ends up in something that looks like what Douglas Hackett was talking. He was talking about the M4 simulations. Sorry, Douglas.
Did you actually
say Hackett?
Should we replay?
Oh well. And at least there are a number of observational things. Another thing is not observed is the I didn't talk about the binary information, but an intermediate mass black hole with a binary is sort of a logical outcome of.
I realize we don't have time for this discussion, but those two bullets. You know, I mean, we've been talking about forming this runaway.
Yeah, I skipped this part.
Getting the IMBH.
Yeah.
Once you have the IMBH, let's say through this way. To get the companion in the right orbit for the right time to get to Rochlov overflow and X-ray emission, there's a lot of ifs there. And
no, it's not so bad. It's not so bad. It's not so bad. I mean, it's not trivial, right? But it is not so bad because the intermediate mass black hole is in a star cluster already. There are stars swirling around.
Yes.
There are stars interacting with the intermediate mass black hole, even though the star cluster is starting receding, right? Because of the stellar mass loss and all the effects due to the heating of the black hole. But there are stars interacting with the black hole. And once in a while, a star may be getting close and may be tidally captured.
Or changed into a binary.
But it's really hard to get into a mass transfer orbit from these parameters.
Exactly.
Yes.
So before you get to mass transfer, you're going to have another dynamic.
Circularized.
Yeah. So you need. It's not a miracle, but you need to do something else to get it to be done. And the type of binary you then get is something like this, where. You have the orbital period and the mass. Let's not go into this detail. But you can get sort of the binary ballpark needed in order to get something what could explain an X-ray source like X1 in M82.
So how many million years you have after your EMBH is formed and before this 25 solar mass actually gone from anything like?
This is about 10 million years we talk about. So the IMBH was formed at an age of about 3 million years, and in the almost 10 million years following that, there were capture events in embodied simulations. You can make binaries out of those, if you make binaries at all out of tidal capture.
What's wrong with this? They can do this with direct embodies. So if it happens in a direct embody simulation, there's nothing terribly that can go wrong, really.
Yeah.
Well, they do it with tidal capture.
Right? Oh, you assume something about...
Yeah,
they do tidal capture.
Yeah, this is not full...
this is not the binary exchange.
This is tidal capture.
In the right orbit.
Remind us what you assumed about...
There are these published equations for how many energy is lost in each tidal event, right? From Ray and Ambia, isn't it? And it's a long time ago that time.
Yes.
and those were used. The results of those.
Kembavi.
Kembavi, yeah, and yeah. And there was another paper which was also.
Just took that delta E from.
Yeah, the delta E over E.
But the pericenter. I mean, you're far away from the black hole. The pericenter passage time is fairly long. This is a very different regime. This is not the usual tidal capture where it's like hitting the star with a hammer and all the modes work.
Well, I mean, let's not go into. I mean, I'm happy to go another time in this discussion, but it's not inconceivable that the intermediate mass black hole captures a star, forms a binary. The companion star, once bound, will leave the main sequence at some point, becomes a giant star, Schwarz loop overflow to the intermediate mass black hole, making an extra binary.
Had no primordial binary, so you couldn't do it through an exchange.
That's right. You couldn't do it through an exchange. Yeah.
Because that might be so much easier.
Right. Now, this picture, the fun story about this picture is I was talking to Alessandro Patruno, who will finish his PhD this April. He's an X-ray observer. And he did simulations of binaries, stellar 20 solar mass, 25 solar mass stars around intermediate mass black holes, 1,000 solar mass black holes. And he was trying to get the orbital period change and to get the luminosity, X-ray luminosity for MA2X1 correct. And then and a mass, he chose a mass between something like 10 and 50 solar masses, put it in an orbit around the immediate mass black hole, and make a sort of a range of parameters to try to get the luminosity right. And he came in my office and he said, well, I get the luminosity right if the star is between 20 and 25 solar masses. And at that moment, the phone rang, and Alessandro said, and the period must then be 62.5 days, the orbital period. And at that moment, the telephone rang, and Phil Kairat said, hey, Simon, it's 62.5 days. And he said, okay, then it's a 25 solar mass star.
This is
pure coincidence. And that's
the other way that you get this right is forget time of capture, but any chemistry is set by the Roche limit.
That's right.
So anything that now I actually do know this from something very different with a mass ratio of about 1 to 1,000. If you have something that sort of plunges into its Roche limit, you know, anything like a parabolic orbit. So you take that star and you send it in, and it goes, its trajectory takes it within its Roche limit where it starts losing mass at pericenter. The response is typically for the orbit to gain energy, which is counterintuitive. But so you might get exactly, with a little bit of mass loss as the star goes within its formal Roche limit on a highly eccentric orbit, which presumably is what you're doing here. Something that just comes from...
But initially it's on a highly eccentric orbit and then it circularizes when the donor...
No way. It's the first, so the typical physics of this is pretty simple. So if the star loses a little bit of mass, 5% or something, through just Roche loop overflow at pericenter, the response of the orbit, so the back reaction of that flow into the orbit, is to make it gain energy. It's counterintuitive, but it will actually never come back. Of course, in the standard tidal capture thing, you assume that it goes in once, you dissipate energy, and then it comes
and
back,
it again.
Dissipates more, and then it ends up circularizing within a factor of two of where the pericenter was. I just don't see how that happens. On the other hand, you know, that's how you get that period.
That's how you get this period, yeah.
It's just a Roche limit here.
Well, there's evolution involved here too, right? Because the moment it's captured, this is not exactly the period that capture period at which the donor is a subgiant and the luminosity is consistent with the observed X-ray source. So it's not directly after tidal capture, but after tidal capture plus some secular evolution.
It ended up at twice the capture radius, and so you needed it to expand by about a factor of two to reach.
That's right.
To start.
That's right. Yeah. So in sense it is the same.
Factor of two. This is still the Roche limit, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's take a break. I see the cookies are out. And come